You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories.
And welcome to episode 349. And in this one, I got Anna Geldard, who has kindly agreed to share her story with us. In particular, we talk about some of her early mental health childhood experiences, school anxiety, how OCD affected her work. She details some of her specific OCD experiences. We discuss depression, medication, postnatal experiences of OCD, getting diagnosed and getting therapy, harm-themed OCD, a relapse, hit-and-run-themed OCD, getting therapy again, going inpatient, feeling suicidal, how menopause may have exacerbated some of her mental health symptoms, hormone replacement therapy for menopause, and so much more.
And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers effective and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. Or the link will be in the episode description.
So thank you to Anna for her time. I deeply appreciate it. And of course, thank you to you guys. As always, it means a lot that you listen or still listen. I appreciate it. So without further ado, here is Anna.
Welcome to the podcast, Anna.
Thank you.
It's good.
Really happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming on. And as you know, I'd love to hear your OCD story. So as little as much detail, it'd be good to hear that now.
Yeah, so I feel like my OCD story is really complicated, and I don't know whether maybe everyone feels like that, because it is not a simple condition. But yeah, it's quite long. I don't really see OCD in my childhood, which I don't know if that's unusual. I have listened to tons of your podcasts, and it does seem that most people can see something, and I have kind of thought over and over, was there anything, but not. But I did definitely have general anxiety as a child, and that really kind of came out when I was about 8 years old. I started having a lot of anxiety about school, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't understand, obviously, it was anxiety. All I knew was that I felt sick about going to school. And I later kind of looked back and I termed it my school phobia. But I don't know. I think now that's even not necessarily a thing. I think it's a bit more complicated than that, basically. So I had all this anxiety about school, and I would feel sick. Sometimes I would be sick. And in those days, like, we're talking like quite old. This is the 80s. Parents were just told, there's nothing wrong with her, you must push her to school, you must force her to go to school. So that's what they did. And they were quite hard on me, but, you know, my parents were just told that's what you should do. But the teachers were hard on me too. Like, I felt very much like I was a problem. The teachers would be very kind of irritated by me if I said I didn't feel well. They'd just be like, yes, I know you don't feel well, you know, and it was horrible, because as an 8 year old, I couldn't understand, and I didn't understand why it felt like they were kind of saying it was my fault. And obviously I couldn't control it. And I used to really, really wish that I wouldn't feel sick. And I'm not religious, but I can remember like praying that please don't feel sick in the morning, and then I'd wake up and feel sick. So anyway, that was kind of childhood. And I did get forced to keep going, and I did kind of come through it. And I was okay. I kind of muddled my way through my teens. Didn't love school, but I got there, did okay my exams. All I ever wanted to do for a career was work with children. And I didn't really know how to kind of, what sort of job, but really all I wanted to do was be a nanny. But my dad was quite high in business, and he wanted me to do something more kind of academic. And I had these A-levels that I got. And so I decided I'd go into paediatric nursing. And it was really at work that my OCD symptoms started to manifest. And it was, I always had the, I always had that underlying personality traits, I think, but I was very much a perfectionist. I wanted to be the best. I wanted to always be perfect. I wanted, you know, I wanted to make my patients get better. And I would always turn everything on myself if things didn't go well. If a patient deteriorated while I was looking after them, my first thought would be, what have I done? What have I missed? You know, have I made an error? And people would like say to me, why is that the first thing you think of? Like, if something happens to my patient, I think, what's going wrong in their body? I don't think, what have I done? But that's just the way I was. And actually, to some extent, it was really praised. Like, people would say, oh, you're so conscientious. You're such a perfectionist, such a good nurse, so thorough. And like, I would be there late. I would never go home on time because I, you know, it's busy. It's always busy. I couldn't finish everything I wanted to finish. So I would be putting in the extra hours unpaid. And I didn't care because in my head, I was just like, I would rather stay an extra hour unpaid and do the things that I want to do and, you know, finish off my work rather than go home and worry. And that was just my kind of mentality. But I think obviously, like, over the years, I kind of like burnt out, to no surprise really, because it was really hard. And I don't really know at an exact point at which it tipped into OCD, but like, so it would go from just being generally very careful and double checking things, and like I say, staying late, to checking and checking and checking. And then I, for some stupid reason, I thought it would be a really good idea to go and work in intensive care. I just thought that it would be a very controlled environment, that it would suit my personality, that because it's one-to-one, like, it would just, you know, I could just do everything I wanted to do for that one child, and that would be a good idea. And actually, the reality was, I was working in a very busy inner London unit, and it was incredibly stressful and scary. And I was quite early on in my career, and I just found it terrifying, and I hated it. And for some reason, I didn't leave. I just thought, I've got to stay. I've got to overcome it. I've got to battle it out. I've got to stay at least a year. It looks bad on your CV if you leave too early. So I was like telling myself, stay a year, stay a year. And yeah, I really struggled. And I really struggled when things did go wrong. Like children, they recover really quick, but they also deteriorate really quick. And there was a couple of really traumatic things. Really traumatic deaths. And again, I would just literally be like, is there anything I did wrong? Did I miss anything? And, you know, I'd go to my colleagues, I'd get reassurance. I'd go to the doctors. I would have to have a chat with the consultant and just say, look at my charts. Like, is there anything I missed? And there would always be no. And actually, I don't nurse now. I haven't done it for a long time, but I've got friends that are nurses, and they actually have told me that these days they do a lot of debriefing. And so I've got a nurse, I've got a friend who's a nurse who works in A&E, and she said anything that's an upsetting situation or a child or something, they always have a proper debriefing. And I think that's probably something that would have really helped me. But anyway, so I kind of carried on this trajectory, and yeah, my I started to do things that weren't normal. So I'd have like drugs drawn up, and I'd be about to go and give them, and I would think, I think I've done it wrong, and I would throw them in the bin. Wasted some medications. And it wouldn't be, there would be no reason other than a feeling of, I feel like it's wrong and I don't know why, and so I would go back and do it again, and then I would get the feeling again. And obviously there's only a certain amount you can do that. So, you know, I was kind of doing it a little bit, and kind of just managing through it. I would be calling work from home if I thought, oh, did I do such and such? I would, you know, call work from home and be like, can you just check this for me? There was one time I called work, and I got this idea that I might have left a needle in a patient's bed. for no reason, just because I had been giving them some drugs with a needle, and it just came into my head, like, what if that needle fell into that patient's bed? And so I rang work. I think my colleagues must have thought I was crazy, although they were very kind. And I was like, I know this sounds ridiculous, but please, could you just go and double check that patient's bed for me? And they'd be like, yeah, okay, fine. They do it. So yeah, so this went on, and obviously I was finding it hard. I had bouts of depression, which, you know, probably was all related. I was on and off antidepressants. But things probably didn't come to a real head until I had my own baby when I was 29. So it then went from work to home, basically. I was really happy about being on maternity leave, because it was like, oh my gosh, I need to get a break from this job that's so stressful. And I was really excited about having a year off. And then, of course, it just affected me at home, which it hadn't. Probably it had in a mild way, like things like hair straighteners, iron on, am I going to cause a fire and someone's going to die, that sort of thing. But it was all quite mild at home. And then, yeah, so I was so over the moon to be having this baby, so excited. I was great all for my pregnancy. I was so happy. And then day three, I just felt like everything gone black, really bad postnatal depression. And then obviously, like, kind of the intrusive thoughts were there as well. And mainly it was mainly about preventing harm, as in, have I done something wrong? Like, have I left something that he might choke on? Or going and checking in the night, he was still breathing, all those things. Me and my husband would make up bottles for like the next 24 hours. So we'd like do a kind of fridge full of bottles. And I'd wake up 6 o'clock in the morning and think, I can't give him those bottles. I think I did it wrong. And I'd pour all the milk down the sink and I had to do it all over again. And like, I would hide that from him. I didn't want him to know that I was doing that, because I knew it wasn't normal. So then I did have some thoughts about what if I hurt my baby. I can remember kind of having these kind of images of me putting a pillow over his face. And I was, of course, I didn't know I had OCD. So I was like, oh my God, you know, this is my postnatal depression, and some women do hurt their babies, and I might hurt my baby. So, like, you know, I sought help. And actually, I was really lucky that no one ever said they thought there was a risk of anything. Because, you know, I immediately was like, they're going to take my baby away. And no one ever, you know, everyone just would say to me, oh, look, he's a lovely, healthy baby and you haven't hurt him yet. So what makes you think, you know, you're going to? Which was probably quite helpful, really, when I think about it, that I didn't have to go through that experience. But anyway, I saw a couple of different therapists. I kind of went from therapist to therapist, and none of them were very helpful. One of the therapists told me that when I had intrusive thoughts, I should get an inflatable hammer and pretend to be hammering on the thoughts. Tend to be hammering out the thoughts.
Yeah.
And when I later told my doctor about that, he was literally like, oh my God, that would have made you worse. So yeah, I didn't stay with her, and I didn't know what I needed, but I knew that I wasn't getting what I needed. And I can remember another therapist, and I remember I said to her one day, I've had this light bulb moment, and I don't know where it had come from, but I was like, I know that the reason why I'm scared of hurting my son, or having the images of hurting my son, is because I really, really, really don't want to. And I kind of had that kind of click in my head that this was coming from not wanting to do it, really not wanting to do it, and just being so scared of causing harm and it being, you know, my fault. And she didn't say anything, really. And later, when I found an OCD therapist and I told him about that, and he said to me, it's a real shame that she didn't say at that point, well, that sounds like OCD, because I think I was definitely diagnosable by that point. And it only really, I only actually got diagnosed. So I then went back to work, struggling still. I changed roles to something really more, less stressful. I was doing a clinic, just a preoperative clinic. So it was well kids coming in that were going to be having surgery, and I was like preparing them for their surgery. But actually, even that, I struggled because I was in Great Ormond Street. So the children have very complicated illnesses and histories. Their notes would be massive. And it was just, I would be worrying about things that actually weren't my responsibility. So I'd be worrying about if their blood tests were abnormal, I'd be thinking, oh my God, what if they go to surgery and no one's noticed that they've got low HB or whatever? And actually that's the anaesthetist job. But, you know, I'd be just taking on responsibility for everything. So yeah, even in the clinic, I struggled. And it all came to head, basically, we were trying for a second baby and I had a miscarriage. And it was really early, but I think it was just that final straw that broke the camel's back. And I just fell apart, completely fell apart. And I'd gone back to work, that's what you do. And it was in the evening and I didn't have any patients left to see. I was just doing paperwork and I just thought to myself, I can't do this anymore. I just cannot do this. This is going to kill me. And I walked out, and that was 2008, and I never went back. So that was the end of my nursing career. And I called in sick, and then my notice period, I was off sick. And at that point, things just really just caved in completely. I started getting these thoughts. So I was at home, obviously, sick with this baby. Well, I suppose he was about 18 months by then. I started getting general thoughts about hurting babies. Like I started thinking, what if like I take him to a cafe and then I hurt someone else's baby? Like what if I I strangle someone's baby when I'm out? And I was getting really frightened, and I suppose I must have forgotten that I'd had this idea that this was coming from not wanting to do it. But, you know, I was maybe just too unwell by that point. And I just started to refuse to go out, basically. I didn't want to go out. Didn't want to go anywhere near anyone else's baby. Just about managing with my own. And then a really lovely perinatal psychiatrist, I was very lucky because we were in London. I don't think they exist too far everywhere anyway. But I'd been referred to a perinatal psychiatrist to talk about having a second baby because I had had such bad postnatal depression. And she said to me, I was describing all these feelings, and she said to me, this sounds like OCD. So, yeah, the perinatal psychiatrist referred me to an OCD specialist, and I saw him privately. And he told me to get this book about OCD, which was Overcoming OCD by David Veal and Rob Wilson. And I got this book while I was waiting for the appointment, and it was life-changing, which I think everyone says when they realise what it is, and you read it and you think, oh my God, I'm not a psychopath. I'm not a danger to society. I'm not going to kill any babies. I'm just scared to, to hurt someone, and I'm trying ridiculously hard not to hurt anyone. And yeah, that was amazing. And there was little things in the book that were just so reassuring. And then I went for the appointment, and yeah, he properly diagnosed me and referred me for he called it CBT. I know everyone kind of calls it ERP now, but it was the same thing. And I saw a therapist privately then, and we did ERP. And I think a lot of me getting better was just realizing what it was, and that it didn't mean anything, the thoughts didn't mean anything. But yeah, I just slowly improved. I saw him for 18 months, but a lot of that was not wanting to let go kind of thing. And just being scared that, you know, I would go backwards. I felt like that for quite a long time. And during that time, I actually found out I was pregnant with our second baby. And that was a real focus as well, I think. And I wanted this baby so much, even though I'd had all these postnatal issues. And I was obviously anxious about it happening again. But I still really, really wanted another baby. And all I wanted to do at that point was be a mum at home. So we moved out of London. We moved down here to Somerset. Because my husband's got family down here, but also because it meant we could afford for me not to work. I could just be a mum at home. And even though I didn't know a single soul here, in fact, we've never even been here before, I was just so much happier. And I kind of built a whole new life, really, at home. Really, the next 12 years were, I was pretty good. I was on an SSRI, but I was on a low dose. I never said I didn't have OCD, like I would always say I've got OCD, but it was really low level. It was really manageable. It would be things like sometimes like I would fill up my kid's water bottle for school and I'd be like, oh my God, did I accidentally put some bleach? Why, like, did I do it right? I don't remember doing it. I'll do it again. And so I'll tip the water out and I'll do it again. So, but it was manageable because it was never more than, you know, maybe two times at the most. And I would really struggle with my hair straighteners and the iron, especially if going on holiday. Like, it'd be very, very hard to leave. I still do that. I check and check and check. I take a photograph. I get other people to check for me. But all of that was manageable, and it was... it definitely didn't affect my kind of daily living. And I never thought for one single minute that I would ever be that bad again with OCD. Like, I just thought that was something that happened to me and I'm over it. And I knew, you know, what to do if those thoughts came back and all those things. And then basically life just kind of got a bit stressful around 2018. My daughter, so I've got three. I went on to have another baby as well. And after my two daughters didn't suffer at all postnatally, which was amazing, but they had supported me to stay on my SSRI throughout pregnancy and breastfeeding, which was really good and really, really positive. It was a completely different experience. When my second daughter was about eight, she started to struggle at school. And it was literally like history repeating itself. I was never going to approach it in the same way it was approached with me, because I felt like it had caused so much trauma. And so I immediately kind of went into school and I was like, she's struggling. She's not wanting to come to school. She's really finding her writing, she was really struggling with her writing. She had a lot of sensory issues. Like, she would be really upset about her socks in the morning, like the seam of her socks. And I sort of mentioned this to school, and they did try, but nothing really was done that really made any difference to her. And so we explored things privately. And we saw someone, and ultimately she was diagnosed with autism. And at that point I thought, amazing, now school are going to help. They're going to put in lots of help for her, and, you know, she might be able to have a teaching assistant and all these things. And actually the reality was it didn't make any difference at all. All they could see was a girl that was holding it together at school, because I don't know if you know much about autism, but girls quite often mask.
Yeah.
And they quite often kind of hide how much they're struggling. Not just girls, but I think it's more of a girl thing.
Yeah. It's harder to detect in girls.
Yeah. Yeah. Much harder. And she was very much that kind of masking girl. And like, sometimes she would refuse to go to school and I'd take her in late. I'd never force her to go to school. I always said I would keep her at home. You know, I'd encouraged her. I really wanted her to go to school, but I never forced her. So some days she would go in late, and the teacher would tell me that she would come bursting into the classroom, like, hi, I'm here, or singing. And they were like, she's so happy. She's so, you know, she's so fine at school, that's the term, fine at school, and they just couldn't see it, and so it was very frustrating. We applied for an EHCP, which is like the you apply to the council to get special needs funding, and it was really, really hard. We were refused. We had to go, we had basically had to go to tribunal. And in the meantime, her refusing to go to school was getting more and more frequent until the point where I couldn't do it anymore. I think there was a day where she was physically shaking to go through the school gate. And I thought, that's it, we're going home and I'm going to have to homeschool her. And I would have never have wanted to homeschool. It wasn't what felt right for our family. But I just couldn't do it anymore. So while we were kind of battling for specialist education for her, and going through the courts and everything, and at the very same moment, COVID hit, and it made everything 10 times harder, which it did for everyone. But it meant, like, so there was a specialist school that we were looking at, but it was a small private school, and it was funded with sort of small investors, and she'd done a trial and she'd got on really well and she loved it. And a couple of days after her trial, the school closed down due to finance being pulled related to COVID. And this school had been there for 35 years. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was just like, oh my God, this was our kind of, you know, this was going to be our one hope. And so that was hard. And the COVID whole thing itself definitely presented some issues for me, because I was like, so my worst fear has always been I do something and someone dies, or I hurt someone and they die. And so suddenly it was like there was a way that could happen quite easily. And I was like, if I get COVID and I give it to someone and they die, that's my fault. And this was really, this really started to, you know, be a problem for me. I was very scared. I wanted to help. There was like requests for people that could sew, to make swabs and all those things. And I really wanted to do that because I can sew. But then I was like, what if I've got COVID and I don't know yet, and I pass it on? And I think people didn't know then how it, you know, that it was mainly passed through the air. Because there was this concern about stuff, you know, being passed from an item. So I'd be fighting to post things, basically. I'd made all these things and I'd put them in quarantine for like a week and all that. And it was really hard. And like, yeah, I was really scared. And so this was all going on simultaneously. And then I did get COVID, and I got it quite early on. It was my son brought it home from school. And it was the November 2020, so before vaccines and stuff. And I was really unwell, but I was really frightened. I was never frightened about me getting it myself or what would happen to me, but I was always frightened about who I was going to give it to and what would happen to them. And I was particularly frightened about my husband, because he's a little bit older than me and he's always had like a weak chest. He gets a lot of chest infections. And I was just so frightened. And I just kept thinking, I'm going to give it to him and he's going to die. And so I refused to come out of the bedroom for an entire 12 days. I did not cross the, luckily we've got a bathroom in our bedroom. I did not cross the line. And I managed to get through it. And I actually haven't killed anyone. I'd been with a couple of people in the days before I realised I had it. And I told them straight away and they went into quarantine and all those things that we did at the start. So I was like, oh, okay. Fine, no one got it from me and died. But I didn't fully recover from COVID itself, which I hadn't kind of planned for. You know, it was always about the kind of social implications rather than the actual illness. And I physically was okay, but I was just mentally not okay. And I knew that I was a bit low, low mood. And it was coming up to Christmas and I had this out of the blue quite bad OCD episode where I had broken some glass near, so I had Christmas presents on the table, and there was a pile of Lego that was going to my friend's kids, and I'd broken some glass near it, but it was sealed. It was in boxes, and Lego inside the boxes. I know it's in plastic bags, but I just couldn't get my head around the fear that what if, like, and it just, I was just, what if some glass got into the box? And I knew that didn't logically make any sense, but I just couldn't get past it. And I knew that, you know, I'd done all the therapy. I knew that I had to ignore those feelings and post the Lego anyway, and I just couldn't. And I can remember saying to myself, been through a really stressful time, just do what you need to do to reduce your anxiety. Just, you know, let's go out and buy a whole new set of Lego, which I did. And I was like, you're not going to worry too much about it. We're just going to do what, you know, and I obviously like did the kind of wrong things, and I knew that, but you know, that was just what felt I needed to do. And then it was Christmas Eve and I was driving, and I was driving over a blind hill. And as I went over the top of the hill, there was no pavement. We live countryside. There was no pavement, and there was a man on the grass verge with his dog. And it was just that, you know, I hadn't seen him from far back. It just was a sudden kind of, oh, you know, it's a man there. He's, you know, he's not on the pavement. And as soon as I drove past him, I thought, did I knock him over? Mm. And I was like, I know what this is. I know this is OCD, and I'm not going to drive back. I am not going to drive back. And I didn't drive back. But by the time I got home, I was just in a complete state, and I was just so upset, and it just, Christmas was awful. I just couldn't get out of my head that, you know, I might have, and I couldn't remember knocking him over, but I couldn't remember not knocking him over. And I was just, it was awful. I couldn't eat, couldn't sleep. It was horrible. And it got to about a week, and I decided to call the police. And I called the police, and I just said, obviously you feel really stupid. I'm sure there's lots of people with OCD that have done things that you know is embarrassing and ridiculous, but you do it anyway. And I kind of said, I know this sounds really silly, but I was driving on this road, and I was just not sure. And I just thought it would be best to just double check whether any accidents were reported, any incidents were reported. And the policeman that I actually got was really nice, which was surprising, because I thought they'd be like, this is a bit weird. But he was like, oh, you know, it's always best to check, no problem. And he like looked it all up, and he was like, nothing's been reported on that stretch of road for 2 years. And so I was like, oh, wow. Like, you know, immediately kind of anxiety gone. And then, of course, it happened again and again. And I really started to struggle with my driving. And I knew that I was back in that place. And I knew that my OCD was bad again. And I was really low as well. I was very depressed. So I decided to get back in touch with my old therapist, who, you know, I hadn't seen for like 12 years or whatever. And because of COVID going on, obviously he was doing sessions on Zoom, which was, you know, lucky because he was in London. And I thought to myself, I'm going to be really proactive. I've done this. I know I can overcome it. I've overcome it before. I know that all I have to do is what my therapist says, and I will be fine. And I was really kind of positive that this would be a few sessions and I would have it kind of under control. And in the meantime, I also saw a psychiatrist, and he put me up on my antidepressants. And basically, I just got worse and worse and spiraled down. And it was really frustrating because I was like, but I'm doing the therapy, I'm doing the ERP, but it just didn't seem to be working. And I think what the problem was that I was so depressed. I think I couldn't probably fully engage on the level that I thought I was, maybe. It just wasn't getting better. I was getting worse. And it went from driving to just general stuff. We live near a big river, and I'm there, I'm walking by them most days, walking the dog. And every time I would see a child or a baby by the river, I would think I'd pushed them in the river, seeing as I'd gone past. There was one day there was a man walking down the street and he was holding a newborn baby, and he didn't have like a carrier or anything. He was just holding this baby, and the baby was so small, looked like about a week old. And I just thought, I think because the baby was just so vulnerable looking, because it wasn't in a, you know, in a carrier, I just immediately after I'd gone past thought, I think I might have strangled that baby. And it was just awful, just so hideous. And yeah, it was just getting worse. And it got to the point where I was out one day walking the dog, and I had this thought that I might have put a kitchen knife into my daughter's school bag. And I rang my husband, and I was panicking and I was in tears, and I said, "You've got to go down to school straight away. You've got to go and get that bag." And he was like, "No, I'm not." He knows, you know, he knows everything. And he was like, "No, I'm not. I'm not going to school to get the bag." And yeah, I was just, I can't do this anymore. I really can't do this anymore. And I got into bed, and I basically didn't get out of bed for 3 weeks. Yeah, I was in a very, very, very bad place. It was awful, really awful. I've never had anything like that where I was just so depressed, like so depressed. And in the end, I saw a couple of different psychiatrists on video, and I kept swapping because I felt like I wasn't getting anyone that was specialised enough in OCD. And then finally, my psychiatrist wanted to bring me into hospital. And we had private healthcare through my husband's job, so he brought me into private hospital in London, and I was there 4 weeks, and it was horrendous. I was suicidal by that point. I just didn't want to live. I just felt so low. Like, I can't explain it. I didn't even know it was possible to feel that low. And I know that I couldn't have gone on feeling like that for very long. It did feel like this. I can't live with this. It's just awful. And every morning I'd wake up thinking, well, maybe I'll feel a bit better today. And every morning I would just be exactly the same. And they were giving me more and more drugs. So by that point, I was on two different antidepressants, an antipsychotic, benzodiazepines, sleeping pills. I was just not getting better. And they didn't. I mean, I've heard people saying this before about when you end up in a psychiatric ward, but they didn't understand OCD. They didn't know anything about OCD. Mm-hmm. My consultant obviously did, and he would come in and see me. But between those times, no one knew anything about OCD. And they were trying to make me go to the therapy sessions. And I was like, I really don't think I'm going to get anything out of it. And sometimes I would go and I would sit there and think, this isn't going to help me. And I can remember thinking, I really like my life. I love my husband. I've got three amazing kids. I'm really happy with my life. I don't know why I'm feeling like this. And I can remember kind of sitting in the therapy and saying that, and basically saying, there's nothing wrong with my life. So I don't really know why I'm here and I've got nothing to say. And they'd be like, well, that's not obviously true because you wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. But I was like, but I honestly, I don't feel like, I just feel like this is a physical thing in my brain. Like, this is something wrong in my brain. This is chemical. This is, I like my life. There's nothing wrong with my life. And anyway, I was discharged and I wasn't really any better. It was just the insurance runs out and you get sent home. And I was better than I was. But I got to the point where I was just not good or bad. So I was like, I wouldn't say I was so depressed anymore. I wasn't that really depressed. But I wasn't happy or good either. I was very kind of that numb feeling that I know people describe where you're just nothing. Nothing. And I can remember saying to my friends, I can't remember the last time I felt happy, and I don't think I'll ever feel that feeling again in my life. I just can't imagine it. I can't imagine that emotion. And yeah, I was like that for quite a long time, but I was functional. My OCD had quietened down, definitely. And I don't know whether that was because perhaps I was less depressed, or maybe it's because I was doing the therapy. So I had another new therapist when I came out of hospital. My consultant wanted me to do compassion therapy. So I found a therapist, or no, he referred me to a therapist that does, she does like compassion, ACT, and ERP, and she's a real OCD expert. So I was kind of doing a bit of everything. But I might spend most of the sessions just crying, and I didn't really know why I was crying. I was just crying. And then, yeah, this continued for a while. I was better, but I wasn't fully better. And one day my friend said to me, I'm going to go to the doctors. I've got really bad night sweats, and my joints ache, and I've been feeling low, and I've kind of looked it all up, and I think it's menopause. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, she's 47, I'm 45. I wouldn't have thought, I thought that was too young. Anyway, she went and she got prescribed HRT. And I sort of asked her after a few weeks how she was getting on. And she was like, oh my God, you just wouldn't believe how different I feel. And I realize now that I haven't been feeling myself for about 3 years. And she said that the first day she put the patch on, her night sweat stopped. And I said to her, oh my God, I've got really bad night sweats. I've had it for all year. And I think I thought it was all the medications I was on. And I remember it being particularly bad in hospital because I can remember we had air conditioning and I would be setting it to like 17 and the nurses would be coming in the morning and going, oh my God, it's freezing in here. And I'd be like, is it? And so I just thought, oh my gosh, I've been having night sweats, and I could, you know, relate to some of the other symptoms and kind of looked it up, started reading, and realised I wasn't too young at all, very much average age, 45. And so I went as well. I decided to see someone privately because I just didn't want to be fobbed off. And I knew that it's not easy for everyone to get HRT. So I wanted to see a specialist. And I sort of told her everything I'd been through. And she was like, brilliant. She fit me in quite quick. And yeah, she said, yeah, I definitely think it's worth giving you a trial. And she, when I said that I'd had postnatal depression, she was like, oh, that's quite, there's often, not always, but often a link. There's women that tend to struggle for like PMS and then postnatally, and then they can be the ones that tend to have trouble in perimenopause mentally. And that is kind of, you know, a thing, basically. And I was like, well, gosh, that makes a lot of sense. And so, yeah, so I got prescribed the HRT and I went on it and felt better almost straight away. Not necessarily mentally, like I didn't kind of wake up the next morning and go, hooray, you know, I'm really happy. But I felt physically better. I felt like I had energy for the first time in forever, and I just felt better. And I felt like my brain had been plugged back in. I felt like my brain had been off and it had been plugged back in. And I slowly, over the weeks, improved, my mood improved. I started to be able to engage with the therapy because I stopped crying. And I had been literally just crying all the time. I'd go up to my husband and I'd just be crying, and he would say, what are you crying about? And I'd say, I don't know. And that all stopped. And then, yeah, I obviously just felt like I could get more from my therapy, basically. So I look at it now and I think it was a combination of everything. And I was still on some of the drugs. I luckily managed to get off the benzodiazepines. I really didn't like taking those, and sleeping pills. Came off them straight away. But I was still on the two antidepressants and the antipsychotic, and I still am. So I don't, you know, I can't say what's what, but all I know is that the combination of everything, I started to improve, and I went from strength to strength, basically. And that was almost coming up to a year now. And I'm still getting there. I still haven't managed to get in the car. Okay. And that's a long time now of not driving, because I just got to the point where it was one day where I not only had these thoughts, but I thought I had I literally had an image of a woman hitting the windscreen, and I could have described to you what she looked like. Like, I had this image, and I said to my therapist, I know what this woman looks like. Like, when she hit my windscreen, she was wearing this and she was wearing that, and she had this hairstyle. And he went, it's the same thing. It doesn't make any difference. It's whether it's an image or a thought or a, you know, whatever, a feeling, it's OCD. And I was like, okay, but it feels different. It feels, and I just could not get in the car again. And so I know that obviously I'm not 100% there, but I'm a million times better than where I was. So that's where I'm at at the moment. Sorry, so long my story.
No, thank you so much for sharing. So obviously HRT is hormone replacement therapy. So I just wanted to say that for anyone that's not familiar with it. Okay, so with your therapist, the lady that does ACT, ERP and CFT, how's that been for you, that kind of trio of therapies?
It really is helpful. I mean, I actually think that had I gone back again after hospital to my other OCD therapist, I think I probably would have done well as well. Okay. I'm definitely getting something extra from the kind of self-compassion. And I can see a lot of where my entire life I've been so hard on myself. But it's still a work in progress, definitely. Mm. And she tries to do a bit of everything. She tries to make sure that I am still doing a bit of ERP. Or sometimes, you know, we'll just focus more on, she does re-scripting, imagery scripting, and we do sort of things like where I have to talk to my younger self, which I do find really hard. I'm definitely feeling like the benefits, and yeah, I feel really positive. And it's actually over a year now I've been seeing her, and I don't really have a plan to stop at the moment. The only thing that is difficult is because she's based in London, because that's where I was referred to her, and I wanted a really, really good OCD specialist, and they're not necessarily everywhere. I didn't really know down here who I would trust and stuff. So it's all been over Zoom, and I do sometimes feel like a real loss of connection, like there's something missing. There's like, it's really hard sometimes to connect. And I definitely think that has been a problem for me. And I feel like it took me longer to really get a good relationship with her. It definitely took me longer. And it was really nice in the summer. I decided to go up to London and just do one face-to-face just so that we'd met. And that was really nice. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a good idea, I think. Absolutely. Mm. What was I going to say? You mentioned, I'm going to ask you about sort of like a light bulb or epiphany moment. And you did mention early on in your story where you had that kind of breakthrough of, I'm worrying about this because I don't want to do it. That's why it's so scary to me. Was there anything else that kind of made something just clicked for you around OCD or the therapy?
Yeah, like probably at several points. I think that probably the biggest one was getting that book and reading the book.
Yeah.
And it just confirming that kind of inkling that I'd had. And like I said, I hadn't really known where it had come from. I just that kind of sudden realization that, hold on, this is because I really, really don't want to do these things. Mm. The book and being referred to a proper OCD specialist and seeing my therapist, my first therapist, was just a massive moment for me. And like I say, it really, really did help me at that time. And then the second time, so I kind of see it as two kind of separate things. the second time, it was interesting. What had changed was, so when I was going through it the first time, which is 2008, I didn't know a single soul that had OCD. I'd never heard of anybody else. And we didn't have social media, or we didn't have it to the level that we have now. So like when I realized I was struggling again, and I started to look online, and I found this podcast for a start, and that's, you know, it helped me so much. And that's partly why I wanted to come on it myself, because it was such a goal for me to, I'd listen to these people that had overcome it or were overcoming it. And I just thought, I can do that. And I can go on it and tell my story. And it was such a thing to keep me, that kept me going. And there was concepts just now and again, there was something that someone would say that would just make so much sense. I know that Shannon Shai was one of the people that you'd had on, and he made a massive difference for me. I went and got his book because just something clicked with the way that he saw it. And that was so helpful, really helpful. And I think he just really focuses on however hard it is to do that kind of leap of faith thing where everything is telling you not to do it, not that, you know, or not to ignore whatever it is, and that you have to go against that if you're going to get better. You have to, because you've got two choices. You've got the hell of OCD and you've got getting better. And if you don't do that thing that is the hardest thing in the world, it's, you know, going to be really hard to get better. And I don't know, it's just something about the way that he'd written his kind of theories and stuff that really helped me. And I did actually, I had a few peer support sessions with him as well. So that was really good. Yeah, probably the main thing. But yeah, finding the community, finding Instagram and everyone, you know, all the people in the community. So helpful.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing those. So words of hope for anyone listening, what would you tell them?
I mean, I would just say, like, if I can get better, then anyone can, because I was very, very, very sick, and I could not see any hope at certain points when I was in hospital, and that was very bad. And if I managed to get better, like, anyone can get better. Like, you really can get better from OCD. And I know that the, you know, the ERP doesn't necessarily work for everyone, or, you know, some people struggle with it more and stuff, but I just think that there is a way for everyone to get better if it's, you know, looking for something like the compassion and those other things on top of the ERP. I just don't believe there's anyone that couldn't get better. So there's definitely so much hope. Definitely.
Yeah. Thank you. So you can pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old you. What do you tell her?
I would say, don't be a nurse. Because, and I know that my OCD probably would have manifested in whatever I'd chosen to do, but I can't help but feeling, and I do feel it, that I maybe wouldn't have suffered quite so painfully if I hadn't have had certain really traumatic experiences. And I did really enjoy it. I loved it, especially at the start. I remember thinking, I'm so lucky to do something I really love. But the responsibility of having children and babies' lives in your hands, what it felt like, it was just really hard. And so if I could go back, I wouldn't do it again. And I really hope my kids don't want, I wouldn't stop them if they want to, but I'm just hoping that they don't feel that way inclined to do anything medical.
Yeah, it's a valid point. So as a therapist, I have supervision and I have my own therapy. Both things help me deal with stuff that comes up that's tough to hear, you know, from clients and stuff. So, yeah, it's shocking that nurses, doctors and whoever else in the medical profession don't have that. And I'm sure it's changing, as you said, some of your colleagues, but yeah, it needs to be for everyone because it's tough. Yeah.
I do wonder now because people say to me quite a lot, would you ever go back? Do you ever miss it? And I always say no. 100% I wouldn't go back, even though, like I say, I did really love it at the start. I just would not go back. But if I was doing it now, whether things would have been different, whether I would have had that more support, because it definitely felt then like you were expected to just get on with it. And, that was just how it was. That was part of the job and you just got on with it.
Last question then is, you've got a billboard in Somerset now. Mm-hmm. What do you want written on that billboard?
So I was thinking about this because I knew you asked it. There was something I thought, it was actually not OCD related, but there was a quote that I saw, and I was really going through it with the court battle to get my daughter specialist education. And I saw this thing, can't remember, on Instagram or somewhere, and it was just, one day your story will be someone else's survival guide. And it just helped me so much. It just gave me that thing of, we will get through this, we will do this, and then when we've done it, we'll be able to help other people. And I have gone on to do that. My daughter's in a wonderful school, and I've supported so many people that have come to me and said, we're going through the same thing, or people have put me in touch with them because they know, that we experienced it. And I have been able to, right from start to finish, so their kids are now in brilliant schools as well, being able to help them. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to come on today, was just because if there's something good that can come out of, such difficult things, then that's so positive to always kind of focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. And lastly, anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
No, I feel like I've literally waffled on and on and on. And I hope I haven't kind of made it too complicated and hard to follow. But no, I really don't. Thank you so much for the opportunity, because I just really wanted to have that kind of platform, really, to be able to just say, like, if you're struggling, and you are maybe a woman of a certain, like, not even necessarily a certain age, but like definitely over 40, just think about it, just ask about it, just look at whether it could be a factor. Because I was in hospital 4 weeks, and I saw 3 consultant psychiatrists, and I saw a whole lot of other doctors, and not one single person ever said anything to me about hormones. Or you're perimenopausal, you're 45. Most women are perimenopausal by 45. I just had no idea. So just look at it, just read up. And I've got various kind of thing, websites and things that I've found that if anybody does want resources to get information about menopause and stuff.
Send them to me and I can put them in the show notes.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's been a real pleasure hearing it. And thank you for going into so much detail. I really enjoyed hearing it.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast.
And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.